Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the health care they need. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. Today on our show, we look at the connection between rising rents in the Valley and homelessness. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Laura Satsui. We also go to San Francisco to meet the Central Valley actor playing George Washington in the award-winning musical Hamilton. And how did one high school teacher change the direction of architecture in Bakersfield?
But first, this week's news. Today, young people in Modesto, Merced, and Fresno are joining a global youth climate strike, demanding elected officials take action to combat climate change. Youth organizer Keyshawn White says the Fresno rally will end up at City Hall.
One of my biggest goals for the strike is to spark a flame in the decision makers, adults, and most of our youth in Fresno to stand up against climate change and see the bigger picture that this earth that we live on is not a singular person planet. It's pretty much all of our home.
And Kern County has lost its title as the nation's top grossing ag producer. That's according to its just out 2018 crop and livestock report. Kern County farmers brought in about $7.4 billion last year, compared with Fresno County's $7.9 billion. Ryan Jacobson, CEO of the Fresno County Farm Bureau, says rainfall was one reason Fresno County had such a good year.
Water really truly does make a difference when it comes to these numbers. Overall, a lot of the crop commodity prices were, you know, not overly, they weren't the highest ever, but they were all relatively strong, you know, across the board.
However, the Bakersfield Californian is reporting that at least some of the change may be attributed to different accounting practices, and that Fresno County may be overestimating the prices that onions and garlic can fetch.
Governor Gavin Newsom signed an executive order Monday calling on state agencies to reduce youth access to e-cigarettes and to launch a $20 million statewide vaping awareness campaign. That came 2 days after a Tulare County man died from a vaping-related illness. Here's Dr. Karen Hott, the county's public health official.
Well, the CDC has suggested that people not vape because of these risks, that unknown, that it's too dangerous. And I would say the same thing.
And finally, the Fresno City Council voted yesterday to support recipients of deferred action for childhood arrivals in a legal brief to the Supreme Court. FM 89's Monica Velez has this report.
Fresno will join more than 40 other cities in a legal brief that supports three DACA cases going before the Supreme Court in November. 2 years ago, President Trump issued an order to wind down the Obama-era program. The Supreme Court will decide if that's lawful. The only council member who voted no for the resolution was Gary Bredefeld. He says DACA isn't legal because it shouldn't be the president's decision to enact a program like this. It should be up to Congress.
And I have tremendous sympathy for people who are here, didn't come here of their own volition, and are making their dreams come true. That's what makes this country great. But we either follow the laws or we don't. And picking and choosing isn't the way to go. And the fact is, people are here illegally, and we have to acknowledge that.
Councilmember Mike Carbasi abstained from voting.
We need to change the precedent that we're not going to wade into these national issues when we don't have the authority to do that.
Councilmember Miguel Arias, who brought the resolution to the council, said the issue is local. He says the more than 5,000 people on DACA in Fresno would lose jobs and wages if the program ends.
It will be a direct and financial impact for our city. So there is a correlation to local.
DACA gives people brought to the U.S. as children work permits and protection from deportation. DACA recipients who spoke during public comment urged the council to support the resolution. They say the uncertainty of the program in the last couple of years has caused them a lot of anxiety and fear. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Monica Velez.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. The musical Hamilton is described as America Then, told by America Now. The music itself is iconic. When you hear the first few chords, you know what it is. And Valley ties to the San Francisco run of the show just got stronger. The role of George Washington is now played by a Bakersfield native. I met him at San Francisco's Orpheum Theater, just outside the stage where it happens. The foyer is bustling after a Sunday matinee. The busy theater and Darnell Abraham's new role make it a little harder for him to go unnoticed.
One of the adjustments for me has been, you know, just kind of going out in public. Folks will come up and ask, you know, are you Washington in Hamilton?
Abraham stepped into the role of George Washington for the San Francisco company of Hamilton a month ago and says he's still learning about the nation's first president.
And my goal with Washington is to strip away the icon and is to really embody the humanity so that we see a man who, yes, was confident, but yet we also see a man who had fears, a man who, when Right Hand Man comes out, Washington is just really laying it out, saying, you know, we are outgunned, outmanned, I need help.
There aren't any recordings of Abraham as Washington, so we'll be referring to the original Broadway cast album. In that album, Christopher Jackson plays George Washington. Hamilton the musical tells the story of Alexander Hamilton, one of the nation's founding fathers. During the American Revolution, Hamilton became George Washington's right-hand man. Still, the Virginian war hero looms large throughout the performance.
He is the founding father, and he's our nation's first president. I think in context of this show, I would say he's the adult in the room. He becomes Hamilton's father figure.
The show isn't just a retelling of history. It considers and reckons with some of the nation's messier issues, like war, slavery, and political compromise.
I remember sitting in a studio back in New York City when I was learning the role, and the song History Has Its Eyes on You. I remember being moved to tears to the point where I actually had to stop working and just let it happen. There's a line in there that says, who lives, who dies, who tells your story? You have no control.
You have no control. Who lives, who dies, who tells your story? I know that we can win. I know that greatness lies in you. But remember from here on in, history has its eyes.
Here I am, fast forward 2019, a black man telling a story about an America then. And I just remember feeling overwhelmed with emotion, gratitude. I would even dare say a sense of grief. I am a descendant of enslaved Africans here in America. But in the midst of all of that, I feel empowered because here at this time in our nation's history, I have an opportunity to be a voice for those who were once voiceless.
That's something that makes Hamilton special. It's a show about the mostly white men who helped establish the U.S., told in rap, R&B, and hip-hop music, by people of color. Abraham says he learned some of the show's dance styles growing up in Bakersfield.
Both of my sisters are dancers, and so, you know, one of them would think of some new dance routine, and they need another body, so my sisters, they would pull me in, and so I would learn very simple street dance steps, and then I also remember stepping, and we see elements of that in the show.
Despite the twist on musical theater, Abraham's mom, Loane Powell, says it's a great opportunity to see history retold.
Now it allows for our children, like for my grandchildren, they're taught this in school, but we're going to take them to see the play and have it performed by people who look like them, which is going to catch their attention.
She and her husband, Tyrone Powell, have already seen the show in San Francisco, but not with their son as George Washington. When they attended, Abraham was playing Aaron Burr.
I have one friend that, when he was a little boy, she said, he's going to be president. And so she texted me and she said, I told you he was going to be president.
Powell adds that what also makes this show special is that she always told her children to learn from history because it always comes back around. To prepare for the show, immersing himself in history is what Abraham has done.
When you go into his room, like, he's watching documentaries on George Washington, he's watching documentaries on King George, just so he could get a deeper understanding for all these characters.
That's Lily Ling, the music director and conductor for the San Francisco Company of Hamilton. Abraham says when he was in school, there wasn't really a hometown musical theater role model for him to look up to.
I had my dreams and my ambitions. I remember watching Denzel Washington movies and being inspired by him. I remember watching Sidney Poitier.
I can only imagine. I know, so I'm from Fresno and Audra McDonald is like...
Correct.
You know, you were like the Bakersfield Audra McDonald.
Oh my gosh, the fact that you just put Audra McDonald and I in the same sentence. Audra, I hope you're listening to this because that is, I'm stuttering over my words right now. That's huge.
But Abraham does realize he's a role model for others now. Just last week, he flew back to Bakersfield to see his old school, former teachers, and current students at Dr. Juliet Thorner Elementary School.
My grandmother would always say, pay it forward. And so it was a really unique and wonderful opportunity to do just that, to say thank you, but also to now go and just sit down with the kids, you know, talk about what makes them excited.
He says Hamilton feels like a celebration because he's in his home state, near family, and he's had the chance to say thank you. He's focusing on the show in front of him and just feeling lucky to be alive right now. Hamilton will be performing in San Francisco at the Orpheum Theater through January. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui in San Francisco. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Alice Daniel. Renters in Fresno County need to make about twice the minimum wage to be able to afford the median monthly rent. Conditions like this contribute to the ongoing issue of homelessness in the Valley. Moderator Kathleen Schock spoke with people on the front lines of the fight against homelessness. Preston Prince and Doreen Ely from Fresno Housing, Desiree Martinez from the We Are Not Invisible Foundation, and Pastor Mike Unger from the Madera Rescue Mission.
Pastor Unger, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about what the homeless situation is in Madera County currently. And I'm particularly interested in the challenges associated with serving homeless populations outside of urban neighborhoods.
Well, it's interesting because I don't think Madera is in any way exempt from the problems that we see in larger areas like Fresno. You know, our proximity to Fresno is only 20 minutes. So I think that what I see is a very cyclical homeless event happening. In other words, when things heat up in Fresno, folks will move to Madera. When Madera heats up in Madera, they'll move to Merced. I would say largely... you know, our point in time count is not nearly as accurate as we would hope. I think there's probably anywhere from 400 to 500 homeless folks in Madera, and the number was half that. The challenges are simple. The folks, in many ways, it seems, have chosen a lifestyle in some cases, and I say more than some, and it seems that that number is growing. And I think it's largely due to the frustrations attached to what we would see as affordable housing and such. And then, you know, anything including the mission here, which is where I'm situated, you know, we have rules, and we're not overly crazy about our rules. We would just ask that lights go out at a certain time and that people, you know, behave in a manner that is not going to be disruptive or a problem for other guests. And again, we're seeing, you know, even though we're housing 80 to 100 people a night, there's 300 to 400 people that would rather not have any rules at all and as such live in what we see here in Madera as the river. I'll be quiet now. No. Sorry about that.
No, thank you. Doreen, I'd like to bring you into the conversation. Can you speak to what you're seeing with the homeless population in Fresno County?
While it is true that our point-in-time numbers did go up, and while it is true that the thing about the point-in-time is that it is just that, it is mandated by HUD to be done in one evening, during the last 10 days of January, during the hours of sunset to sunrise. So you can imagine that it would be virtually impossible for any community to have this exacting count. We get more than 200 volunteers to do that. We go all over Fresno and Madera County as much as we possibly can with the volunteers. So I will agree that the count may not be exacting. However, I think that it is a pretty good measure of homelessness in our community, at least some kind of a picture of it. And from that, we can go forward. I do not characterize persons experiencing homelessness as making necessarily a huge choice. It's not about you get up one morning and you say, you know, the corner of Shaw and Blackstone is for me. I think I'll just walk away from everything. It's a series of things that happen to people, decisions that individuals make. There could be substance abuse. There could be mental health issues. It could have started with losing a job. Certainly, affordable housing is definitely a factor in getting people housed. I just believe that there are several reasons why people are homeless, and I think Dads can really speak to the fact that there's not one of them that actually want to be there.
On the point in time count, I feel like it's way under. The numbers are like half. Whatever the point in time count is, I would double that. I would definitely double that. Only for the simple fact that it is at the end of January. It's cold. It's rainy. I experience majority of the street family members going into abandoned buildings, abandoned homes, building tunnels on the side of the canal. A lot of family members do come around winter time, the holidays. They allow their family to come home for that period of time. So I don't think our point in time count is good. I would like to see one in the summertime. I believe they will get a more accurate number during the summertime and day hours, because we do go out at night. We do have one day, but we do go out at night, and nobody wants to come outside their tent. Nobody wants to talk to you. It's cold. It's rainy. with the homeless individuals, I have come across people that are, the older they are, they seem they're set. They're tired of fighting. They're tired of asking for help. They're tired. They are set in their ways. It's harder with the elders. They don't want to move. They don't want to do anything. They're just there at rock bottom depression. I'm tired of asking, Des. There's a couple of elders I wanted to bring to the new low barrier. They turned it down, and I was shocked. I was really shocked, because after being out there so many years, seeing what they went through, now all of a sudden you have a chance to go, and you're like, Des, they're just going to make us leave. What am I going to do in 90 days? I'm going to be right back here.
Probably a mixture of depression and just years of frustration.
Yes. So they're just affordable housing. We need it. Because in order for them to transition out of that 90 days, where are they going to go? Back to the street. And you can't return for another 30 days. But everybody loves the low barrier so much that they're always constantly full. There's never a bed available. Not one day. So if we have affordable housing here, then I think we'll be able to place more people into permanent housing and fix the solution.
Well, that's a perfect time to bring Preston into the conversation. Tell us about the work that you're doing around affordable housing and helping people make that transition into permanent housing situations.
Well, I totally agree with Des that the issue of homelessness should not be treated by itself. It should be really as part of a system look, and that includes housing, education, workforce development, health. It's all of these systems and how they come together. I think the homeless individuals and families are the pressures that happen from all of the systems not working that leads to people being on the streets. And in Fresno, we know that there's a need for about 40,000 housing units, affordable housing units. We have a crisis in California on affordable housing. It's very different in the Bay Area and LA to Fresno. We don't necessarily have the high costs of housing that they do there. What we have instead is a really low income level for families and households and the inability to pay higher rents. We're starting to see market pressures pushing families out of the housing market. Low-income families in Fresno on average pay more than 70% of their income towards rent. That means that they have very little money left over for transportation, health, food, utilities. They're making choices within their means, but they're not able to pay all of the bills. So we are, the Housing Authority is, we serve 18,000 families today. Our average household income is around $10,000 a year, or $10,000 a year in income. And we're thinking of ways of how to build more housing. We've built 3,000 units over the last 10 years. It'll take us 100 years to meet the needs of the community. So that is not possible, and it's not a good idea. We are working with a lot of community partners to create more capacity, more investment into Fresno, into housing, and that would be housing for all income levels, and it would be housing for homeless individuals as well. Desi's totally right. The triage centers and some of the steps that we're taking to address people in crisis are really wonderful, but if we don't have the exit strategy into permanent housing, that is how you end homelessness, right? If someone has housing, that we're going to fail as a community. So we need to build more housing. That's going to take more investment. We've had a reduction in federal funding and state funding for housing and local funding with the redevelopment authorities being abolished a number of years ago. Under the current governor, with Governor Newsom, we're seeing an investment back into housing. So we need to leverage that and create more housing. We need new production methodologies, and we just need to build more housing. That's the answer.
You know, this is, it's one of those situations where it's a very simple solution, build more housing, but a very complex problem.
Right.
And you mentioned partnerships. And I think that's such an important piece of the puzzle, given the complexity of reasons why people end up in homeless situations. Pastor Unger, talk a little bit about some of the work that you do in partnership with other organizations in the Madera area. I'm sure you can't do it all alone.
No. Being a faith-based organization, obviously, there's a certain component of church involvement within our community in reference to support of the mission. I hate to say this because it's kind of an indictment against the faith community, but in many ways, there's an investment fiscally for what we do so that we can endeavor to provide a Band-Aid. And there's very little hands-on involvement from the church beyond, you know, the, I guess, if you want to call it a monthly support. We do work in concert with CAPMD a little bit here and there. I had a meeting with the DSS yesterday, and in trying to find ways to have them on site a little bit more, but I run the risk when it's going to sound terrible again, I run the risk of running folks off as soon as a government agency, if you will, starts lingering, if you will, and it's a mindset, I think. I could be off on this, but in many ways, we're seen as that neutral individual, that neutral component in this, and that we're hopefully not going to come in as a judgmental. And I know that the Housing Authority and the organizations that I think are gathered here today, you wouldn't see yourself that way, and I'm sure that they don't see you that way. But there's still this leery, you know, how much are they really interested in what we're doing? We have a fairly large migrant farm worker community here in Madera that does utilize what we have as far as services, and I think there's a concern in their minds that as to who knows who we are, sort of thing, and we're doing our best to kind of keep an anonymity for those individuals because we see them as needy, needing our help if we can.
Absolutely. That's such an interesting point.
Well, and can I add to that? Because I totally agree when it comes to migrant families that the threat that is being imposed on us as a public agency of disclosing information is real, right? And so I totally think it does lead to people not wanting to disclose information to us. And so it is something our board has taken a position on, saying that they do not support some of the national policies. But within that population, it's definitely an issue. And then with partnerships, I also agree with Ms. Stronger that it has to be lots of people coming together. And what we're trying to do in with the Fresno-Madera Continuum of Care and with Fresno City and County is really broaden the governance and oversight of addressing homelessness, particularly. So we're doing this through what we call Street to Home, with the idea that if we can get faith-based, philanthropic, private sector businesses, as well as government and nonprofits together, that we can address everyone comprehensively, right? And take the different approaches that maybe the rescue mission has from the housing authority and be able to address everyone, because we are all going in the same direction, and give people who are on the streets the choice of who they want to work with and what best works for them, using data and collecting data and being able to create the right solutions based upon what works and has the best outcomes. So it is through partnerships and collaboration that we have to work.
You're listening to Valley Edition. We're discussing the issue of homelessness in the Central Valley. Doreen, your work with Fresno Housing is, I would imagine, twofold. You know, there's one issue is how to find housing for people who have found themselves homeless. The second is to prevent homelessness in the first place. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you could speak to some of the best practices around homeless prevention for families that may be at risk.
We try to practice a strategy called diversion, meaning so that when you come to us in the beginning to say that you have an issue with paying your rent or utility bill, or there's something that may prevent you from staying in your housing, for us to see if there are things that we can do that will assist you in doing that. And to be honest with you, diversion is something that we're really starting to roll with a little bit better in Fresno. We really didn't have funding to do that prior, but now with some funding that has come down from the governor, we're able to get that started. We don't have a whole lot of results that I can give you stats on, but I think within the next 3 to 6 months, we should be able to see exactly how those strategies worked for us. So we're really looking forward to doing that. The other thing is, sometimes when a person presents and with the possibility of being homeless, there are sometimes, if they're living with a family member, if there was some kind of argument, I mean, it's just all about really being really concentrated on that individual and what their situation is, and helping them to really advocate and figure out what it is that would work out best. As Des said, our triage centers are very full at the moment. We are doing our best to get people out. We will extend the 90 days as we see fit to do so. But it's the upstream. It's people are becoming, or who, as Preston said, are spending 70% of their income on rent. That can be really, really hard as time goes on. So trying to do those kind of diversion strategies.
Des, you founded the We Are Not Invisible Foundation based off your own experience dealing with homelessness.
Yes.
I'm wondering if you could share with us, based upon not only your lived experience, but also your advocacy work, what are the areas around homelessness that are most misunderstood by the community?
That we want to be there.
Tell me more.
My advocacy came because of all the hatred from housed individuals in the community. You get people asking you, do you want something to eat? If you say yeah, they'll throw it at you. You have a lot of people that walk by and just ignore you, plainly ignore you, like you're not there, you don't exist, you're invisible to the working class community here in Fresno, California. You can know somebody, and if they see you and they know you're homeless, they know you're going to ask for something because you know them. But unfortunately, some people just will put their head down, be on their phone, and act like they didn't see you. Yet again, we're invisible. But everybody complains about us. Everybody complains about those people, those people, those people. Growing up, I was always that person. Those people do this, those people do that. So experiencing homelessness, I was like, wow, this is like divided here in this arena of homelessness, and the people I used to look up to are looking down on me now. You know, I used to work in a law office. I used to work at the courthouse. I used to work at the sheriff's department. I've done many things. I worked my whole life until I had back surgery due to a DV. That changed everything for my life. I started to see what it was like to live on a fixed income, what it was like to be in a type of relationship where you felt you couldn't get out of because you didn't have the income yourself to support yourself. Experiencing all that, going for help, there was no resources. None. Everybody told me that they were full, that they didn't have any resources, there was no more money. Margie Mason Center told me I had my car to sleep in. Wow. So I wasn't considered homeless in their guidelines.
Their definition.
Yes. So it didn't fall into that. That's what led me to street homelessness. I waited 3 months. This wonderful caseworker over there fought for me, got me in and stuff. During the process, I was still going to school. I was trying to raise awareness and tell everybody, look, we're not all bad. We don't want to be here. There's people, there's workers, there's ex-football players, ex-millionaires, you know, people that own businesses that went under, people that were married and they got a divorce and then they lost their job due to depression, sleeping in their car and their car got towed because of tags and now they're literally on the street. The only way to escape it was through using some type of alcohol or drugs to survive, and now it's turned into something deeper. But just raising awareness, being out there all the time, I started to experience a lot more stuff that we needed out there. And that's why I have so many different types of projects. And I always tell everybody, my first thing I'm always going to do is always advocate for the homeless. Always, always. There was a part of accountability thrown in there too, because we can't just put it on the individuals that are here in the shelters or programs. We have to look at are their case being managed correctly fast enough for them to exit the way that everybody wants them to, so we can right. prevent homelessness.
Right. It's society and individual actions coming yes. together to create
and better. Employment. Yes. We have to throw employment in here. How can we give them a voucher for an apartment and not have employment to back it up? Because some of these programs do end. They give you a year, 2 years, but come on, like, we need to push them into employment or have some type of employment attached to the housing and the low barrier shelters programs here.
Well, I thank you all for being with us today. This has been a really fascinating and eye-opening conversation. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. Air quality was in the headlines this week as the Trump administration said it plans to revoke California's ability to set its own tailpipe emissions standards. Such a move would certainly have a local impact. Meanwhile, the Valley Air District made a few decisions that could also be significant for local air quality. Here to talk more about this is FM 89's Carrie Klein. So yesterday in particular was a big day for local air quality. What happened?
Yesterday, our air district, the San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District, approved two mammoth plans aimed at improving air quality specifically in South Central Fresno and Shafter. Now, these plans were mandated as part of AB 617, a state law that set out to increase community control over air quality. And South Central Fresno and Shafter were chosen as some of the first 10 pilot communities to get this kind of attention across California. And starting last fall, each community formed a steering committee made up of residents, business owners, and government officials. And they have met multiple times per month ever since to determine their own priorities in terms of improving air quality and improving air quality monitoring. And so Fresno and Shafter's plans voted on yesterday were prepared by the Air District and with considerable input from community-based steering committees, and they both were voted in unanimously by the Air District's governing board. Here's Samir Sheikh. He's the director of the Valley Air District.
Not everybody that was in the process got everything that they wanted, but I think everybody in the process got something that they wanted, and I think that was really evident, again, in the programs that came before our board, and that's why you saw the unanimous support from our board.
So what is in these plans?
There's a lot. One plan was 1,000 pages, another was 1,200 pages, wow. plus a whole bunch of subsequent updates. So it's not super easy to summarize. But, you know, a couple highlights include that they both bring in a lot of, they're full of community projects, essentially. A lot of them are in the form of incentives. So they incentivize things like replacing the parts of trucks and trains that pollute the most, or replacing some of the more polluting agriculture equipment that's out there, and also upgrading old buses to electric or hybrids. The plans also include more outreach related to alternatives to open agricultural burning, working with cities to study the routes of heavy-duty trucks to see where they might be rerouted. And so all in all, these plans involve working together with lots of jurisdictions like cities, counties, water agencies, pesticide agencies to get these projects done.
That all sounds like it could end up to be pretty expensive.
Yes. All of these things together add up to tens of million dollars of investment. The final number has not been set yet because a lot of this will still be changing. And none of this will just happen automatically. It's like a wish list. The state has provided some money already as part of the AB 617 process, but it has yet to be seen how much more the state will grant and how far that'll go in getting to all these projects.
Mm-hmm. So then how do community members and business people in these areas, how do they even feel about these plans?
That's an interesting question. Community members themselves, especially those not affiliated with local industry, they tend to not see eye to eye with the Air District in general, neither do environmental justice agencies. But there was actually a lot of agreement when it came to these plans. Yesterday's vote was during a public meeting, and about a dozen people stood up and gave comments related to each plan. And overall, most residents, business interests, and environmental justice advocates said they support these plans. However, there were caveats. The plans won't actually come to a vote before the state Air Resources Board until February. And many of yesterday's speakers said they expect to see more changes to the plans in the next few months, that they want them changed before they go up before the state. So after the meeting, I spoke with Estela Ortega. She's a resident of South Central Fresno, a member of the steering committee. And she said she's really grateful that she got to be a part of this decision-making process. And she supports the plan that came out as a result.
No al 100%, pero sí.
So it's not completely what the community wants, but what she would like to see is more of the funds going towards community.
And by that, she means more regulations on heavy industry, more attention toward rerouting truck traffic out of neighborhoods, and more tree planting. A representative from Dairy Cares also spoke. That's an organization promoting sustainability of dairy farms. He said he supported the plan in general, but wanted to see more incentives related to helping dairies reduce their emissions. The group in the room to support these plans the least appeared to be the nonprofit advocacy group, the Leadership Council for Justice and Accountability. Policy coordinator Ivanka Saunders says the decision-making process improved tremendously in the last year, but
there's still some major gaps that need to be filled in.
By that, she means there's too much reliance on uncertain funding. She wants more regulation on diesel trucks, more funding for plans to reroute truck traffic, and she wants more guarantees from partner agencies that they'll actually collaborate with the Air District on these projects.
Those are the gaps that still need to be fine-tuned before it's voted on in February by the Air Resource Board.
So it sounds like the work on these plans isn't really necessarily done yet.
Yeah, that's the way it's looking. The steering committee's plan to keep tweaking these plans until they come before the state in February. And Samir Sheikh with the Air District tells me they do plan to start implementing some of these projects as early as possible. Meanwhile, the Air Districts and the state are in the process of selecting next year's communities to be a part of this community air protection process.
And then, of course, the other big news this week was the Trump administration's threats to revoke California's ability to set its own vehicle emission standards. Can you talk briefly about what that means and what locals have to say about it?
Yeah, for almost 50 years, California has had a waiver that's allowed it to adopt tougher standards for the emissions that come out of tailpipes, tougher than the federal EPA. Mm. And for a long time, the Trump administration has been threatening to revoke this waiver, and finally yesterday it did, though the change won't go into effect for 60 days, and lawmakers have already promised to sue. Litigation could take years. In the meantime, Samir Sheikh, again director of the Valley Air District, says changing vehicle emissions in California, specifically increasing them, or at least certain components of them, will have a huge effect locally, not just on public health, but also on economics, the penalties we pay, and the agencies that have assumed certain emissions when making their own emissions plans.
So for a long time, we've been working with CARB and the federal government to continue reducing mobile source emissions. as really a necessary component of bringing the valley into attainment of these very tough federal standards and achieving the clean air and public health goals that we've been pursuing as an agency.
Environmental justice groups also warn the dangers that this could do for public health, as well as climate change, if more greenhouse gases and other emissions are allowed to come out of tailpipes.
All right. Thanks so much, Carrie.
Thank you. Bakersfield is well known in the arts for its contributions to country music, notably the Bakersfield sound. But it's not as well recognized for its architecture. A new exhibit at the Bakersfield Museum of Art may help change that. It's called Bakersfield Built: Architecture of the 1960s. Several events are being held in conjunction with the show, including a symposium and guided tour of modern homes this Saturday. Here to speak with me is the symposium's planner, Sion Winship. She's the president of the Southern California chapter of the Society of Architectural Historians. Welcome to Valley Edition.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Alice.
The 1960s were a prosperous decade for Bakersfield. The population was growing and the city's residential developments were spreading eastward. But those things don't account for good architecture. At the root of the city's mid-century modernist buildings is the vision of one high school educator, Clarence C. Collamore. Tell us about him.
Well, Alice, Clarence Collamore was an architect and an educator who came to Bakersfield in 1910 after he graduated with a degree in architecture from University of California at Berkeley. He actually came to Bakersfield to teach mechanical drawing at Kern County High School, which, of course, is now present-day Bakersfield High School. But within 2 years of his arrival, he started an architecture program at the school. It was a very sophisticated program that involved 2 solid years of training in architecture, and it also made extensive use of competitions between students on specific design problems. He actually instituted an annual trophy for the competition winners in 1922, and each student's each winner's name was engraved on the cup. So it was a bit of a, you know, the Stanley Cup for architecture at Bakersfield High School.
And that's pretty rare, right?
Very rare. Yes, very rare. But what Collamore did really was he created this talent pipeline. His promising students went on to study architecture in college, first at Ivy League schools and also at Berkeley. And then when USC started its program in 1916, a steady stream of Collamore students flowed through that program. And interestingly, by 1939, Bakersfield had more practicing graduates of this USC School of Architecture than any other city outside of Los Angeles. So many of the architects we're featuring in the exhibit and on the tour are winners of the annual competition and former Collamore students and went on to graduate from USC. They include some names such as Robert Eddy, William Painter, J. Warren Wright, Eugene Choi, his brother Alan Choi, and Clarence Barton Alford.
And so going back to the 60s architecture, of course, a decade earlier in 1952, an earthquake destroyed hundreds of structures downtown, and that also gave architects lots of opportunities to reframe the way the city looked.
Absolutely. USC was also one of the first architectural programs in the United States to emphasize post and beam style modern architecture. So the Collamore students of the 40s and 50s who went to SC were well trained in that style, and when they ultimately returned to Bakersfield, that's what they started building. And it's especially apparent in East Bakersfield, where new homes were built, schools were constructed, and modern commercial buildings were needed to serve the community.
And can you describe post and beam architecture?
I can. So if you think about the way a traditional house looks, almost if you think of a child's drawing of, you know, 4 walls and a roof, post and beam architecture allows you to change that up quite extensively. And if you think of a capital T shape, the T is a post, which is usually wooden or steel, and then the crossbar of the T is the beam. And by using post and beam style construction, you no longer have to make walls of a building carry all the weight. The beam now carries all the weight as supported by the post. And what that actually enables the architect to do is it frees up the open plan. It allows architects to replace what would be walls with large glass panels. It allows spaces to flow effortlessly from one to another, and that's what creates the modern aesthetic.
And it's hard to talk about architecture in the mid-century without mentioning this country's most famous architect, Frank Lloyd Wright. He was commissioned to design a house in Bakersfield from a couple named George and Millie Ablin. What can you tell us about that home?
The Ablin residence was built in 1961, but it was one of the last residences designed by Frank Lloyd Wright prior to his death in 1959. And the fellowship actually dispatched one of the Taliesin fellows, Thomas Olson, to live in Bakersfield for a year and a half and supervise the construction of the Ablin residence.
And Taliesin was his architecture school.
Yes, Taliesin is Frank Lloyd Wright's School of Architecture with campuses both in Spring Green, Wisconsin, and in Phoenix, Arizona. In the design of the Ablin residence, Wright extensively used the equilateral triangle, which, if you need to brush up a bit on your high school geometry, is, of course, a triangle where all sides are exactly the same length. And what's interesting about the equilateral triangle is that if you put six of them together, almost as if you had a pizza, it creates a hexagon. And Wright used the triangle and the hexagon to formulate the plan of the Ablin residence and also the angles of the walls that appear in the house.
So could you also describe the house a little bit more?
Absolutely. So it's a house made of commercially produced concrete block. The concrete blocks have an open design in them so that you can see through the concrete blocks in some areas. And the house is basically anchored at its very center with a very large fireplace. And to the north and south of that anchor fireplace are two long wings, one of which was for the Ablins' six-plus children, and the other one was for the Ablins themselves, their own private bedroom, and an office for Dr. Ablin. So it's quite the tour de force. It has also a giant glass prow that looks out onto the golf course.
And is it still a private home?
It is.
That's one of the symposium panels is talking about the influence of Frank Lloyd Wright. What about the other panel? It's called Collymore Students. You have a great story about how you tracked some of them down, and it starts with locating all of Collymore's papers, which are now archived at CSU Bakersfield.
Indeed. So in about 5 years ago, David Coffey, Bakersfield resident and founder of Bakersfield Built, created the first exhibit, symposium, and tour. And that one was focused on Bakersfield architecture of the 1930s. And it was held in conjunction with the 75th anniversary of the publication of Grapes of Wrath. And so I began searching for materials to use in that exhibit. And I reached out to Clarence Cullimore's son, who was also an architect. And I dialed up the phone, and unfortunately someone answered and let me know that he had passed away just the previous week. Mm. So I offered my condolences and rather gingerly explained that I was looking for material for this exhibit, and the person told me that there was a garage full of papers that was going to be thrown out the following week. So I hung up the phone and immediately called David Coffey, drove to Bakersfield, and we found 30 boxes of Clarence Cullimore's own architectural plans, some student projects that he had saved, photos of the students who had won the cup and competitions. And David loaded everything into a truck and took it to his office for safekeeping and ultimately arranged to have it donated to Cal State Bakersfield. And it was these materials that I used to research and find former Cullimore students. And I was able to track down two that we have on the panel who remember being taught by Cullimore in detail. And we'll talk about how important it was for them and the career decisions they made later in life.
And just how important is Cullimore's influence on Bakersfield?
It's extremely influential. You know, when you look at the number of architects that were building in the 1960s in Bakersfield, the vast majority of them came through his program, went on to USC or another school, and then came back to Bakersfield to work in the offices of other architects. The other thing that Clarence Cullimore did, which I always found very interesting, was these annual competitions. He would have them judged by the architects that were already working in the Bakersfield community. So it was a real opportunity for the local architects to see this homegrown budding talent and to get to know them. They often offered them summer internships or jobs after they graduated from college. And then in turn, those students would go on and open up their own practices in Bakersfield and really pay it forward, which is one of the things that I think makes the architecture community in Bakersfield so special.
And would you say that type of mentorship is still continuing?
I think it's a different time now, and I don't think we have an emphasis on architecture at the high school level, but the architecture community up there continues to be very close-knit, and you'll see that in our architects panel, which is the third panel we have in the symposium on Saturday.
And then finally, after the panel, there is this home tour. We talked about the Frank Lloyd Wright home. Architecture is such a visual medium, and radio is not. I'm still going to put you on the spot here and ask you to describe maybe one of the other homes.
Absolutely. So the majority of the homes that will be featured on the tour, you really see this USC training in post and modernism in full force. And I think one of the best examples of this is we have Robert Eddy's own residence on the tour. And I think that an architect's own home is also a really wonderful opportunity for people to see what the architect is experimenting with and thinking about, because of course he has himself for a client, so he has the opportunity to stretch his design aesthetics a little bit more and the ideas he might be kind of working out. So you'll see in the Robert Eddy residence that there's a lot of glass. There are a lot of integrated interior and exterior spaces. There's a tremendous dialogue between the public spaces and the backyard of the house, the exterior of the house. It's a very free-flowing, open, light, and airy example of post and beam modernism. And as I alluded to before, Eddy was a Cullimore student, a winner of the student architectural competition at Bakersfield High School in 1933, and a graduate of USC. So it all kind of comes full circle.
Well, that sounds like a great chance to get to know Bakersfield architecture in the 1960s a little bit more. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Sion.
Thanks for having me, Alice.
The Bakersfield Built Symposium takes place at the Bakersfield Museum of Art this Saturday from 9 a.m. to noon. The home tour is from 1 to 5. For more information, go to bmoa.org. And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook.
Don't forget to check out our app. It's called KVPR, and it's available for free on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by the KVPR News Team, Alice Daniel, Monica Velez,
Carrie Klein, and Laura Satsui. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Laura Satsui. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need. On the web at chcf.org.